Brilliant, thank you. Yes, so that, thank you, Anne. This is a joint project with Enrico Uliana from the University of Cape Town. And yes, as you mentioned, I'm from University of Western Australia, so there's a nice photo with the university campus in the foreground. UWA is, of course, famous as being the home of Philip Brown, also Anne Tarker. We've also got lots of black swans, as you can see there, that appear on that river. So a black swan event is not exactly rare in Perth. So in this paper, we explore different ways of calculating diluted earnings per share. And we look at three different methods. So the current International Accounting Standard 33 method, a method we develop in this paper, which we call the earnings adjustment method, and then a third method that comes from a 2002 paper by Kaur, Ghee and Kothari, which we call the treasury option method. And our findings actually suggest that the current IAS 33 method is the weakest of those three. So you might ask, well, what's wrong with it? Well, what's the problem with the current method? Well, it's very old, actually much older than that telephone you can see on my slide. The rules in International Accounting Standard 33 are largely drawn from APB 15, which came out in 1969. So that, of course, means it predates all the important work that was done by Black-Scholes and Merton in the 1970s, which completely revolutionized our thinking in this space. And of course, there's been a number of developments since then. The only change in recent years actually was a small change in and around 2002, 2005, when IFRS 2 came out. And that standard made a small change to the way the strike price was calculated for IAS 33. And it said you should add the unamortized or the as yet unrecognized IFRS 2 expense to the strike price of the option for the calculations in that standard. But otherwise, the rules are pretty much as they were in 1969. So we seek to address this question. So what is the best method to calculate diluted earnings per share when a firm has outstanding employee stock options? We focus on employee stock options because they're reasonably pervasive and they quite neatly illustrate the issues that we're concerned about. But we do note that it would be quite easy to extend our method to other types of dilutive instruments, like convertible bonds, convertible preference shares, other equity-linked derivatives, etc. So the other question you might ask is, well, who cares? I mean, certainly the standard setters haven't looked at this for a long time, obviously. But we think it's quite important. The diluted earnings per share is arguably the most used accounting metric. In fact, it's the only accounting metric that you'll see if you look at the stock pages of the Australian Financial Review, for example. If you do a stock search on Google Finance, that's the only accounting metric that would appear. We also know from previous research that analysts look at diluted earnings per share a lot, and that is the figure that they tend to forecast. So we think it's reasonably important. So if we have a look at what does IAS 33 prescribe, IAS 33 requires you to assume the following sort of dummy transaction. It says that you must assume that the current share option holders immediately exercise their options and that the firm issues new shares to settle those options. Right, at the same time, the firm then takes the proceeds from the call option exercise and settlement and repurchases its own shares. So the net effect of those two transactions is then the increase that in the number of shares, and that's the number you have to add to the denominator in the basic earnings per share calculation to determine the diluted earnings per share. So we've sort of tried to capture that dummy transaction in that formula that's shown on the slide, where NO is just the number of options, X is the exercise price, and P is the current share price. So a little bit of algebra, and you can then manipulate that formula, and then you can see it looks something like that. P minus x, let's see if I can show. So the P minus x then, of course, is just the intrinsic value of the option, and we can see there that the standard only looks at the intrinsic value of those options. It, of course, then ignores any at or out of the money options, completely ignores the time value of the options. And we know that the time value can be quite a significant component of the total value of an option, particularly if it's sort of near to at the money. So if we have a look, Corgi and Kothari proposed quite a simple solution to this problem. So instead of using the intrinsic value as we had in the previous slide, they changed that to the fair value of the option. And so we then capture that additional time value that was missing in the previous formula. So if we look at the IAS33 method, it uses the intrinsic value, a simple change to the fair value of the option in the Kaur et al. Formula allows them to capture more of the dilutive effects of those options. And their subsequent empirical work suggests that the current treasury stock method only captures about half of the total dilutive effect of these ESOs. Lunsman, Peasnell, Pope, and Yee also had a look at ESO accounting. They were a little bit more focused on the balance sheet and the income statement accounting. So they used the Olsen framework to argue that ESOs should actually be treated as a liability. All ESOs should be treated as a liability and should be carried at fair value through the income statement. So that they were quite concerned about the discrepancy between equity settled and cash settled ESOs. In this paper, we develop our own formula, our own model for calculating diluted earnings per share. We again utilize the Olsen framework with adaptations suggested by Hess and Luders for ESOs. And we come up with the following formula. The derivation is shown in the paper. I'm not going to go through all that now. But importantly, in our formula, we say that the earnings, so in contrast to the other two, where they adjust the number of shares or the denominator, we adjust the numerator, the earnings in the calculation, by the change in value of the options. So we think that's quite a neat solution because it has a couple of advantages. First of all, at a diluted earnings per share level, it deals with the discrepancy between equity settled and cash settled ESOs. So at a diluted earnings per share level, you're now getting exactly the same treatment for both sets of incentives. It also could easily be extended to other types of dilutive instruments by also just capturing the change in value of those instruments within the earnings figure. And so it can then help to deal with some of the discrepancies perhaps between debt and equity that arise from the operation of IFRS 9, for example, where IFRS 9 accounts for some instruments at fair value through the income statement and others not. We compare our approach to the other two papers. Well, Kaur, in deriving their formula, they assume that firm value is just simply a multiple of current earnings, right? As in a sort of PE ratio. Whereas our model, of course, allows for the slightly more complex relationship that's embedded in the Olsen model between firm value and accounting information. Kaur don't consider this difference between cash and equity settled options, so they don't even try and address that. That's not a concern for them. It is, of course, as I said, a concern for Lunsman et al., but they didn't really look at diluted earnings per share. They were focused on basic income statement and balance sheet accounting. They did say that ESO should be accounted for as a liability. We don't think that's worth revisiting. We think IFRS 2 is sort of working reasonably well, but we do think that there's work to be done around diluted earnings per share. And we do note that our solution would provide a very similar answer to Lanzmann et al. At a diluted earnings per share level. So that leaves us with three methods, right? So our method, the earnings adjustment method, whereby we adjust earnings or the numerator by the changes in fair value of the options. We've got the treasury stock method from IAS 33, which adjusts the denominator, the number of shares with the intrinsic value of the options. Then we've got the core method, which we call the treasury option method, which also adjusts the number of shares, but with a fair value of the options. Interestingly, neither of our method or core, so neither of those analyses suggest that there's any adjustment necessary to the strike price of the options. So we can't find any theoretical justification for that requirement that was introduced by IFRS 2, that you add the unamortized expense to the strike price of your ESOs. We then, to try and sort of get a sense of how these methods might work using some numbers, we ran them through a set of very simple examples. So we start off with a simple firm that has 10 shareholders, has a cash asset of 100, and that asset generates a known return of 10%. So in that scenario, all else being equal, we'll expect that the shares would be worth 10 at the beginning, would be worth 11 at the end of year one, would be worth 12.1 at the end of year two, etc. And that the earnings per share should be 1 in year one and 1.1 in year two. And then we just increasingly add complications to that scenario to try and illustrate some of the effects of our methods and how ESOs get introduced into the accounting. I'm going to jump forward to example three. So one of the problems with ignoring the time value is that the time value really captures two things. The first thing is just basic discounting that we get from the time value of money principle or concept. The other thing that time value captures is uncertainty, right? And we know that the more uncertainty there is, the bigger the time value is, right? So in example three, we try and deal with the first one. So just basic discounting. So we have two periods, a multi-period setting. And we can see if we have a look at those numbers, everything is as we'd expect, except for the treasury stock method, which straight away we can see is understating the dilution of those ESOs. And that's just simply because it's ignoring basic discounting that we find with the time value of money. Everything else seems to be working fine. We're getting the EPS numbers that we would expect. So we then, in example four, introduce uncertainty as well to see how that sort of impacts the calculations. So what we do here at the end of year one, we introduce uncertainty whereby at the end of year two, there's two possible state realizations. Each one is equally likely to occur. And that uncertainty results in an increase in value of the options. And of course, then a shift in value away from the existing shareholders to the option holders. So we have a look what happens to our numbers then. So the earnings adjustment method continues to exactly measure the change in value of the shares, right? So if we see what's happening to the value of the existing ordinary shareholders, the earnings adjustment method is exactly capturing that change in value. Interestingly, the treasury option method does a pretty good job of measuring dilution, but it's not capturing the change in value of the existing shares, but is the best indicator of next year's earnings, right? So that's the one that best reflects the following year's earnings, which is interesting, and it's something we explore a bit more in the paper. And the existing IS33 method continues to understate the dilution of these options. So what do we conclude from our examples? So the earnings adjustment method best captures the change in value of the existing shares. So that best captures any changes in wealth for the existing shareholders. The treasury option method, interestingly, is the best indicator of future earnings. So depending on what you think the primary purpose of EPS is, you might prefer one of those over the other. And the treasury stock method seems to be the least useful of those three. Right, so then in addition, and at the suggestion of one of the reviewers, we decided to run our earnings adjustment method through a couple of real world companies, so using some real world data. Employee stock options are not used that often in Australia. Most Australian companies tend to use shares rather than share options to incentivize their executives. We were, however, able to find five companies that had issued share options. And in each case, we looked at their results over the last 5 years, except for Reece. Reece had only issued options in the last 2 years, right? So all in all, we had 22 firm years of data that we looked at, so to speak. And in each case, we then try to recalculate our earnings adjustment method, or the adjustment that you'd need to make to earnings to calculate our diluted earnings per share. And we did that by first calculating the closing balance, so the closing value of the options outstanding. From that, we subtracted the opening balance, we subtracted any options granted during the year, and we added back then any options exercised or options forfeited. So for each one of those numbers, we needed to make a number of assumptions and simplifications, because the companies are only providing very highly summarized data around their ESOs. And of course, in that summary process, a lot of data gets lost. So of course, if the companies were to calculate these numbers themselves, they probably get quite different numbers. But we still think it's interesting because it still gives us a sense of the magnitude of some of these adjustments and what the adjustment might do to the diluted earnings per share number. So there's a summary of our results. So the full results are shown in the paper. CSL is a very big company in Australia. At times it's the biggest. I think at the moment it's about the second biggest company on the stock exchange. So it's quite an old company, quite mature. Its earnings are quite mature. Its share price pretty stable. So the earnings adjustment is normally quite small. In fact, the biggest that we found was just over 2% in 2018. So the earnings adjustment relative to profit was just over 2% in that year. And again, a reasonably small difference between the earnings adjustment diluted earnings per share and the statutory diluted earnings per share. The EAM was only 1.76% lower than the diluted earnings per share per IAS 33. But even for CSL, we found if you just focus on the dilution on average was about 3.5 times higher under our method as compared to the IAS 33 method. You can see for Afterpay, the results very different. Afterpay is a very new company. Its share price has been screaming up, so rapid share price growth there. So it's had some very large earnings adjustment amounts. It also, being a new company, has very small accounting profit, and in all 5 years, it made a loss. So if it's making a loss, generally there is no dilution recorded under the existing standard, whereas we were picking up quite large dilution relative to the accounting profit, as you can see from those numbers. A zero is kind of similar. It's also a sort of more of a new economy type company. It runs a cloud-based accounting software package out of New Zealand. So the share price more volatile. Also the accounting earnings quite small and often negative. It also showed no dilution in all the years except for one. And so we get quite big numbers there. And we can then again, so we can contrast that with Reece, which is an old plumbing retail group. So again, you know, the share price is generally quite stable, accounting earnings large and quite stable. So the impact there much smaller. Car sales is also an older online used car sales platform. So again, tends to be a bit more stable. And has and there's smaller effects there. Car sales, however, had the only sort of significant positive earnings adjustment. So because the EAM is a change in value, it can be positive or negative, right? So in 1 year, we had a, you can see there, the 0.8% adjustment upwards for the diluted earnings per share. So if you're used to the sort of anti-dilutive approach of IAS 33, where you only look at instruments that reduce your earnings per share, it's a bit of a change. But we think is still reflective of those shifts or changes in wealth. Right, so I think that was all I wanted to say there. So what do we conclude from our test sample? Again, IAS 33 significantly understates the dilution effect of these ESOs. We see that you can have very large EAM adjustments, right? So especially if the profit's small and the market cap is large, so if you've got a big PE ratio, you can have quite large adjustments coming through, which results in quite significant diluted earnings per share volatility. However, we did notice that with Xero in 2021, they had a 2,000% dilution that they showed in their accounts for under the existing method. And that was because of a call spread transaction that was unrelated to their ESOs. So you can get quite large volatility even with the existing method. And then, as I said, the diluted earnings per share calculated under our method can be higher than basic EPS at times, which is a bit of a departure from what's been done in the past. So what do we think are the implications for standard setters or standard setting? We think our method would be a significant improvement to the standard. And that's because it provides a single, simple platform that would at once align accounting between cash and equity settled ESOs. It can also be easily extended to other types of dilutive instruments. So we wouldn't need separate rules for convertible bonds or written put options or convertible preference shares, for example. You can have sort of one principle that applies to everything. And then, as I said, could also be a platform that you could use to reduce some of the discrepancies at a diluted earnings per share level between the treatment that we get in IFRS 9, where some debt instruments are carried at fair value through P&L, whereas equity instruments are just simply carried at cost. So it could be a platform to try and resolve some of those differences that we get from the mixed model approach in IFRS 9. I guess if you don't like our method, we do think that CORE's treasury option method would be a significant improvement and would be pretty simple change. It would be, you know, one or two word change in the accounting standard. So that's something that could be done quite simply and I think would make a big difference. None of our analyses or the examples seem to justify that adjustment to the exercise price. So we can find no reason to adjust the exercise price upwards with that unrecognized, unamortized IFRS 2 expense. So we think that should just simply be removed. And then I think, as is perhaps clear, we think there's probably a little bit more work to be done in this whole debt versus equity space. To try and clarify those rules. And perhaps diluted earnings per share is another tool that the ISB could use to deal with some of the issues that arise from that current mixed model approach, so that you can perhaps get some kind of parity at a diluted earnings per share level. Right, that's me. My thanks, and I look forward to your comments and feedback.
Thank you, Warwick, and it's great to see some academic work that's leading standard setting. We're not even got a project on this, and that's great. I'm going to hand over to Millie Chang now for her discussant's role. Millie, you have 15 minutes if you wish. Millie, you're on mute still.
Are you able to see my slides? Yeah.
Yes, we okay. Yes, we can see your slides.
Good. Okay. Oops. Thank you for the opportunity. Oh, I'm in darkness. Thank you for the opportunity to read this paper. I really learned a lot. It was nice to revisit Olson's model after such a long time. Okay, let me go to the paper. I'll just jump into the contributions of the paper, and Warwick's already covered this, but I'll just revisit what I believe are the key contributions in the paper. So in this paper, a method was derived to capture the dilutive effects of employee stock options, ESOs, by accounting for their change in value, change in future value, and including issues relating to expiry and the issue of new options. So this is where the change to earnings is in terms of the change in fair value of the ESOs does the heavy lifting in accommodating the change in value to the shareholders. As Warwick mentioned, this method can be applied, is equally applicable to both equity and cash settled ESOs, which have different accounting treatments. So that makes it a simple method to apply. And lastly, the main difference with this method and previous methods, the TSM and the TOM, is that the adjustment is done in the numerator instead of the denominator, though I note that Core et al. Noticed that there were probably errors in both the numerator and the denominator in the measurement of diluted EPS. So just to quickly go through, Warwick's already gone through this, but I thought it was important to show the claimants to the firm value. Here we have both the shareholders and the option holders making claims on the value of the firm. And in this way, the clean surplus is used, the X minus D, the earnings minus dividends. So as I said, the change in fair value of the options does the heavy lifting in this method, because it covers all the expectations of future abnormal earnings. So it has to account for all future abnormal earnings. And let's see whether it can account for all future abnormal earnings. So I have some questions. It could be due to my misunderstanding of the paper, but when I looked at the equation, it occurred to me that whether the EAM, the earnings adjusted method EPS, was actually equal to the diluted EPS in the derivation, because if we start off with the change in book value equals earnings minus dividends, and then if we break up the change in book value to the two owners of the firm, the shareholders and the option holders, we get X minus D, and in the equation you've brought the change in options to the right-hand side of the equation. So what remains is still a change in value. Although I noticed when you were discussing this method, Warwick, you talked about the change. But for me, at the moment, it would seem that we're still left with a change in shareholder value on the left-hand side of the equation. This is nicely divided by number of shares. So I think there's an easy way to get around this issue, and that is to just take away from the right hand side of the equation the beginning book value, and then you will arrive at the end book value again. The other thing I was thinking about was whether it was sufficient to only consider the number of shares outstanding. I thought about this from the Kaur et al. Paper, where they talked about the dilutive effects of the ESOs being affected by option delta and also option intensity. So I was wondering whether the number of options or option intensity relative to the number of shares outstanding needed to be taken into account, so that it was not simply divided by the number of shares, but also maybe to consider the number of options outstanding in the equation. So those are my two recommendations to perhaps adjust the model side of things. And my other comments deal with the empirical application, perhaps of the method. So you mention in the empirical examples here the use of the five firms listed on the ASX. And so what I did was I did a very dirty calculation of the means of the EAM to profits and the change and the difference between the EAM and the diluted EPS. And I have the old firms number, and then I have in the second row, I have the figures where I take out the afterpay and zero, which were the more problematic firms in the sample because they had price volatility and also losses. I think that was a bit of a problem. So you're right, with the old firm means, it was 335.6%, but when we took out afterpay and zero, it came down to 1.32%. And similarly with the last figure, the comparison between the EAM and DEPS, it went from 162% to just under 1%. So that made me wonder how important this adjustment will be for firms like Xero and Afterpay that have volatility in their earnings, volatility in their prices, and firms that experience losses. It could well be that the EAM doesn't make sense for these type of firms, or they are in fact capturing the intended effects. The other issues to consider was is how useful this adjustment will be for shareholders, for investors. Because as you know, the research shows that there are mixed findings as to the usefulness of the diluted EPS for investors. And given the scale of the change relative to DEPS, the diluted EPS, I'm wondering how useful investors will find this information, or will it only introduce further noise into the earnings number? So I think a doable way of answering this question is to compare the EAM EPS to stock returns to see whether the information in this new measure of earnings per share is captured in returns. Another thing that occurred to me was whether ESOs are value irrelevant. I think one of the assumptions made in the model is that they are not. And this is a little bit more difficult to explain away because we know from a few papers that were done that that managers make different decisions when the firm has ESOs and because of the dilutive effect on EPS. So the Benz paper shows that the increase in stock repurchases, the Lee paper shows it has an effect on credit ratings. Whether you believe the change in credit ratings is new information or the combination of existing information. And I think the third one shifts away from real investment to repurchases, and we can see that this would have an effect on earnings, future earnings, and maybe future abnormal earnings. So this is where it gets a little bit more complicated, in my view, for the simple change in the fair value of ESOs to take into account all these effects, the different managerial decisions that will be made as a result of the ESOs. Some other comments are, I was surprised really to find there were only five firms on the ASX with ESOs. So as you said, it could be because Australian firms don't issue employee stock options. That could be one. But if there are only five firms, this may not be a big problem in Australia, potentially. In reading the paper, I would like to have seen perhaps more of a discussion of the Hess and Luders paper, given the importance of its introduction of the value of shareholders and the value of option holders in the equations. And perhaps, and maybe this is a little bit cheeky of me, you've given examples and they were very good examples, but they were perhaps a little bit highly parameterized, and would like to have seen maybe an analytical solution to this method. And the last minor comment is with table two, the last column. I think for firms with losses, you should have perhaps taken the absolute value of the EPS in the denominator, and then the statistics there would have made more sense in total. So that's all I have, and I hope. I have understood the paper and provided you with some useful suggestions. Thank you.
Thanks, Millie. We're going to now go to Zach Guest, who's an IASB member, for his comments on this paper.
Okay, and I won't have a presentation, slides, so for that, and you'll get
that's fine
face instead.
Everyone's got to concentrate really hard.
It's a way to bring all the attention to me. But I wanted to start by thanking you for the paper and the presentation. I think the thought and attention that went into it were fantastic. Thank you for allowing me to comment as well. And to echo Anne, I thought it was an invaluable second look at the issue of diluted EPS. It's an area that doesn't get as much attention today, but one that is certainly worth taking a fresh look at, and one that I used in my prior background and talked about a lot with investors on different ways they could analyze the issue. Which leads me into a discussion of my background, which is a caveat. My background's in investing, both direct investments and then working with investors on accounting issues. So that background sort of doesn't determine my views, but it does inform them. And it means that my comments are likely to focus on the conceptual arguments presented rather than the specifics of some of the modeling and derivations. So pardon for that. I had to go back and look at the objective of IAS 33. As an investor, you don't typically look at those sections. You just look at the calculations and figure out how they work. But I'm going to start with the objective because I think it's important in framing why it was created the way it was, which is the objective of diluted earnings per share is consistent with that of basic EPS, to provide a measure of the interest of each ordinary share in the performance of an entity while giving effect to all dilutive potential ordinary shares outstanding during the period. And I'm going to focus on the second part of that objective, because unlike basic EPS, we want to include dilutive potential ordinary shares, and the order of that is important. It's dilutive potential rather than potential dilutive, which I think gets at the crux of your argument on the TOM methodology versus the treasury stock method. And I think you did a really good job of demonstrating some of the weaknesses of that aspect of the standard. And so if I'm looking at the totality of the current objective, it's clear that the proposed approach, which is focused on adjusting performance figures, would be a pretty big departure from how we view and how we create diluted EPS today. That's okay, though. As my fellow board members know, I'm okay with change and even radical change if we're improving financial reporting and at a reasonable cost. And I think both of those parameters would be met. But as we assess whether the proposed change would be a substantial improvement, I think the paper really does get quite effectively at the key assessment in section 10. If diluted EPS is meant to capture the change in value of one share, then I think it's likely a superior approach conceptually. But if the diluted EPS is best used to predict future earnings, then applying the fair values rather than the intrinsic values might be a superior approach. And as I look at the current state of diluted EPS, I would say first that it's fairly complex and opaque for users. I would agree with the view that it understates dilution. So I actually coached investors on how to take away some of that. It was a little different from the methodologies that were in the paper, but conceptually it was the same time value of money, in particular working across different scenarios. Because the information that's actually provided in the footnotes and in the disclosure shows the difference between basic and diluted share counts, as well as changes in the numerator, but almost never gives information on how those numbers were developed. And I think that's important. I think you did a great job of highlighting the weaknesses of the treasury stock method in that aspect. But in terms of current usage, I think for investors, current diluted EPS is used as a headline number. And if you look at stock price performance, companies tend to be credited for outperformance in the numerator, but less so for EPS beats driven by a lower than expected denominator. So typically those are repurchases during the period, which tells me that at least that stock prices appear to move more in line with current performance, assuming it's seen as sustainable, than with movements in the share count. And as we look at forecasting for each of these metrics, we tend to see equity investors model performance when they do, which is net income to common shareholders, and share counts separately. And in forecasting performance, they frequently back out volatile items, not necessarily related to the current period's financial performance, to facilitate their work. This is the whole explosion of non-GAAP. And modeling separately the diluted share count, the users either assume that the diluted share counts increase at a steady rate, or alternatively, some go back and do some more complex calculations involved with new share issuance, forfeitures, and importantly, the relationship between future price forecasts and the financial instruments within the scope of diluted EPS. One last thing to note in terms of the model, a lot of analysts, and particularly buy-side investors, derive value based on cash flows directly. They don't use the performance figures. And so adjusting earnings through the numerator and not providing information on the denominator would probably be a less net loss of information for those investors, and something to think about carefully. And unfortunately, I think for me, it means the sum of the above is suggesting that the most valuable information used by investors is actually the dilutive content of currently outstanding financial instruments. One current policy think would be worth exploring and doing a little bit more on relates to this non-GAAP and alternative performance measures. Because I think you did a great job walking through some of the details around why stock-based compensation is appropriately included in expense. I think that's a good settled debate. But for companies that exclude stock-based compensation from the numerator of their diluted EPS, there's a second effect, and you talk about that as well. And I think you could do a little bit more because future stock-based compensation is also an anti-dilutive effect in the denominator. And in all my experience looking at companies, hundreds of them that have employee stock options, I've only encountered one that actually adjusts the denominator for that anti-dilutive effect. And so I think for regulators, as alternative performance measures continue to grow, it would be a fantastic area to talk a little bit more explicitly about that and say, okay, there's no theoretical way or no theoretical reason, which is the argument you make for excluding stock-based compensation expense. But if you're going to exclude it in the numerator, perhaps you should be looking at the denominator too, where it benefits you, because we do have representational faithfulness as a key criteria. And then one last point that I think hits on one of my earlier comments that I think is worth thinking about is there are some areas of finance that are really hard to summarize and present with one best final answer. Which I'm stealing from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, sort of shamelessly. Finding that final answer, the one best way to do it, is what modern financial accounting really works to do. And as standard setters, we're constantly reminding ourselves, look, our job is to find that best answer, and disclosure is not a substitute. But this is an area where I think we may want to question that assumption. Because when you talk about something that's as opaque and complex as this, in terms of the diluted share count and how we calculate that, I think there's really a role that disclosure could play in terms of describing a few key pieces of information, which are what instruments are outstanding and what the terms of those instruments are in terms of strike prices, expiry, what the price of the stock would be in the future, which is something investors have a view on. That's their job. They're paid to do it. And what human behaviors will affect those instruments. So for example, forfeiture, employee turnover, performance metrics, all those things go into forfeitures. And ultimately, it's a circular discussion because stock price has a huge effect. And you're forecasting stock price, which has an impact on stock option, forfeiture, or exercise. And when we use the treasury stock method, and when we created it, personal computers largely didn't exist, as you pointed out. Today, if I had a CSV file of a company's outstanding options with a few key data points, I'm fairly confident I could find a 24-year-old graduate of University of Western Australia who could build an effective model for predicting future dilution, not as a single point estimate, but as you mapped out, there's a range of expectations. And if you could map what the share count would probably look like at each of those estimates, I think most investors would love to be able to do that. And it's something that could easily be done as a standalone component. So I think it takes the future share count from being a roughly modeled estimate to a pretty good figure that's automatically computed for a variety of scenarios. So in thinking about both your method and some of the others, I would pay a little bit of attention going forward, or maybe think about what the effect is on transparency versus opacity of the calculation. Because if investors and users of financial statements have alternative views, the ability to adapt the current accounting is a key consideration. With that, I just want to thank you again. I really loved reading it. It definitely got me thinking, which I think is a fantastic objective for the paper. I think my conclusion is that for most users, it would be something that they would find interesting, but might make their jobs harder, but certainly worth thinking about for the future.
Thanks, Zach. I will cross to Warwick in a minute to get his responses. He's had a lot to process from Zach's enormously helpful comments. Can I please see if there's anybody with their hand raised who'd like to ask any questions, or if you just indicate in the chat line if you've got any questions. But I do thank Millie and Zach for their very helpful comments for Warwick. Warwick, do you wish to respond?
Just one or two comments if I can. So first, thank you very much for your feedback. Very, very useful. Lots for me to think about, and a couple of things I'll need to stew on first. There was one or two things that I thought was worth discussing. Millie, I think you said something about, does it make sense to show diluted earnings per share at all for Afterpay and Xero? I think that was sort of the gist of your comment. And I think, you know, it's a fair comment. I think that's why I sort of pointed out the volatility that arises from using the method. Does it mean anything? I guess I sort of took two things away from that. Is A, for those mature companies, the results was quite stable, which to me was a good thing. For those companies that weren't mature, the result was quite volatile, which I think was important. So bear in mind, the existing method shows no dilution, so that dilution, potential dilution, not communicated at all. And to me, if I can find two examples in a sample of five, it suggests that there's quite a few instances of this problem. And I think from a standard setter's point of view, they want to know two things. Is it a big problem in some instances? So I think, you know, for companies like Afterpay and Xero, it is. And is it very rare? Because if it's very rare, then nobody cares. So, well, in my sample of five, I had two instances that seemed pretty pretty large. So to me, I think it is something that the standard setters should be looking at. I'm just having a look. I think, Millie, you suggested that I compare my method to stock returns, which is something that CORE did in their paper. So, yes, certainly something I would like to do. I guess to me that felt like the next paper where I might sort of explore this issue empirically. I suppose here I was really just trying to crystallize what the problem is, what does it look like. I always liked the examples. I thought the examples worked well to illustrate the issue. And so, you know, so after that, I didn't think I had much room to do any kind of empirical work, but that is something I would like to do. I mean, that's why when the reviewer first asked me to look at a few companies and look at their actual numbers, I said, no, that's out of scope. But I realized, no, you know, it was a good suggestion. And if you can take a small sample and you can see something, then, you know, that probably tells you something quite useful. I only found five firms that had ESOs. I'm sure there's lots more. I didn't look for very long. It's quite hard to find firms with ESOs. So you sort of have, at the end of the day, you've got to trawl through their annual reports to see if they've issued ESOs or not. And then once you've found that, then you try and trawl through to find the ESO information. So it takes a very long time to gather the data. And so I was only able to collect the data for five firms. At the end, I thought five firms times 5 years was a pretty good sample to sort of give us an idea of what's happening on the ground. And I sort of stopped there, but I would guess that there are a lot more firms with ESOs. But as I did say, I do know in Australia it's less common, right? So most firms here tend to issue shares. And then, Zach, I think in your comment around that we need more information, I absolutely agree. So whilst I could find pretty good information around ESOs, it was highly summarized, but felt, you know, like they'd done their best and there was quite good information. There's hardly any information around what are the dilutive instruments, why are they dilutive, how are they dilutive, and how did we calculate the adjustment to the denominator. They'll give you sort of one or two lines, they'll refer to another note, and when you look at that note, it's not at all useful. And so you're just sort of hoping that they calculated this thing correctly. There's no ways you could use that information to do your own calculations. So if you wanted to calculate the dilution in any other way, there's no ways that there's enough information. And I guess, you know, my primary purpose behind the paper is really just to encourage discussion, you know, point out this issue, which I think has been a bit neglected. And if you said to me at the end of the day, well, you don't like my method, but you think we need to give a lot more disclosure around these instruments, and maybe it's pointless giving diluted earnings per share at all, as you suggest, but we should just give a lot more information around these potentially diluted instruments and how they might affect the results in different scenarios. I think that would be a big win. And the rest I will try and incorporate in the next version of the paper. So thank you again.
Thanks, Warwick. And hopefully we have a recording for you so you can tease out those comments from Zach. So there's been a couple of comments from Zach and Warwick about the disclosure of the information. I think I heard Zach say that the investors can't work out the matters of dilution, and Warwick has referred to that as well. So I know that we've got some other board members on the call at the moment, and we've got a couple of our auditor, ex-audit partner board members. If either of them would like to comment on disclosure around diluted EPS, just put your hand up and I can call on you if you want to join into this conversation. As Zach says, we always enjoy talking about disclosure and changes to accounting standards. And we're very conscious of the investors. Yes, Tadiu, thank you. Would you like to speak?
Yes, actually, this is, again, a very good paper and very interesting subject. And I'm just used to say that rainy in the wet, but diluted EPS is an area that in the past especially generated a lot of restatements. And then every time that I see something that will make the calculations more complex, I'm just thinking that this number will increase. And then I can get to Zach's point that maybe we have to make a balance between when we are going to a too complex situation and we can address this through a disclosure. And I agree with the idea word would be to incorporate it, but I think that a good balance to put a light on this issue through disclosure may be something acceptable. Otherwise, it just an exercise so complex that we just increase the chance of preparers getting it wrong. And I can tell you as and said, based on my background as auditor, even the auditors, not all are knowledgeable to manage and audit a very complex calculation. And then usually they have to ask for their more expert colleague to do that. And it, when you have quarterly information, et cetera, it just gets more and more complicated. I tend to agree with Zach that if we can address it, and I fully agree. And again, I'm a fan of the EPS because it is a good measure for something that actually is not clearly in the P&L, and then it just gives you a very good idea that the P&L is not capturing. But again, it's very complicated, and we can't fight the statistics. Thank you.
Thanks, Tadiu, for joining in, and thanks for that. There are no other hands up or questions, unless Tom's going to come. Tom, do you want to speak? Tom.
I wasn't going to, but I will, given that nobody else seemed to put their hand up. So I actually liked the paper a lot. I was particularly pleased to see two ancient papers of mine get cited at the beginning. So that was always nice. In one of the two, though, and I'll just sort of, the more interesting, because we looked at SEC disclosures way back in time that had to be filed. So they weren't in the financial reports or anything, but it appeared clear that somewhere, someone in the market was going and looking, because what the one paper showed was that the response to earnings surprises was conditional on the amount of overhang of these instruments, which I think goes a little bit to what Zach said. That's a way of using the simple disclosure. So the more of an overhang of dilutive instruments were out there, the less the response of the market to an earnings surprise with respect to stock price. And so that was, I just kind of raise it because it seemed to me that paper fits actually nicely between what Zach was saying, what Warwick did. And these are clearly not mutually exclusive. So I really like the paper because Warwick's getting it a way of, I think, doing a better EPS model. But you can, as Zach said, you can never have an EPS model that's going to capture all of what users would want to do. And so people will still need to know the overhang. And we actually got the neat thing was we got a really significant result with a relatively crude measure of the overhang. And so the kind of things that Zach was saying, I think, you know, we got a more detailed sense would be valuable. So I'd kind of really encourage Warwick to keep working and doing this because I don't think we have a really great solution. But I think any solution would have both disclosure plus some neat EPS measures. The other thing I might just say about it that I liked was I thought Warwick's insight that EPS is fundamentally a proprietary concept measure. That's worth developing because we say that we're entity concept, but we're a kind of a hybrid, actually. We just don't mention the proprietary elements. We're not a pure entity concept, if you followed it. I think that was also really useful work, and maybe I just might even ask you about, you know, how you came to frame the issue in that way, and are there other insights on this proprietary entity that you might think of pursuing?
So, Tom, I think it came primarily from that whole ESO debate. So if I remember correctly, there was a lot of debate around that. Should we be using the proprietary or the entity concept? And, you know, depending on which school you sat in, you might think that ESO should be a liability, which I think a lot of commentators seem to do. And other people say, no, it's equity. So I think that's probably where I got the idea from. I mean, I think originally this paper was an ESO paper. And over time, I've realized, no, this is actually more of a diluted earnings per share story. I think it does tie in, you know, as I said, it ties into some of these debates around debt versus equity. You know, and we often get caught up in that categorization and trying to get the P&L right. And, you know, so again, that's why I was saying, well, you know, if you want to go with the entity concept and use that for the P&L, that's fine. But then maybe we should be using the proprietary concept for EPS. And as I said in the paper, I don't really see how you can look at EPS any other way. And maybe that's a, you know, way to show some of those other effects that are coming through that don't get captured in the existing mixed model.